You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio. On air, online, and on digital. Subscribe to our free podcast service. Details on our website, abc.net.au/conversations.
People who are albino, the people who are born with that condition that's called albinism, always make an impression with white hair, the super pale skin, and the pale blue eyes. In some places, they're seen as magical people. In parts of Africa, for example, there's a belief that certain body parts of people with albinism have magical powers. Consequently, albino people are persecuted and sometimes even dismembered. In other places, they're made outcasts because they're just presumed to be bad luck. And if you think this kind of thinking is limited to tribal societies, well, think of movies like The Da Vinci Code, where an albino plays a ruthless, inhuman assassin. In fact, it's claimed that The Da Vinci Code was the 68th movie since 1960 to feature an evil albino. Well, Dr. Shari Parker is not an inhuman assassin. She is, in fact, a doctor. Shari is from the Albinism Fellowship of Australia. Shari Parker, welcome.
Thank you.
You were born with albinism, which means you typically have the white hair, the blue eyes and the pale skin. How does it affect your vision?
With albinism, you don't have any of the pigment melanin. And melanin is really important with the normal development of the eye pathways in utero, so when the baby's in mum's tummy. And so people with albinism, myself included, have got a range of different eye problems. Firstly, with that development of the normal eye pathways, the back of the eye, the retina, and particularly the macula, which is what gives us our very precise vision, don't form properly. And so our visual acuity, or how much the letters that we can see on the chart, is generally less than normal. As a result of that, the body tries to compensate with this thing called nystagmus, which is the wobbling eyes, the side-to-side eyes. And some of the kids call it, cartwheeling eyes or dancing eyes, which I think is a much nicer term. And then many people with albinism will have a turn in their eyes, so a strabismus, which I have. I call it my mad eye moody. Other effects are the photophobia, so the severe light sensitivity. And finally, we've got poor depth perception, because normally the nerves from your eyes cross to go to the other side of the brain, which gives us our stereo vision, and that doesn't happen in albinism, so we've got poor depth perception.
How about in your own case? So how does that affect what you read? Do you have something like, 60% or 50% of normal vision?
Yeah, so I've got about 10%. So 10%. The rating, in the best case scenario for me in the doctor's surgery, I've got about 660 in my right eye, my left eye, my worse eye, and 636 in my right eye. But take me out into the sunshine, make me stressed, give me the flu, put all of those things together, the vision is poorer.
Do you find, and would this be true in social situations for any person with albinism, that you get asked the same questions all the time?
There are a few standard questions that we do get asked. You can probably imagine them. Are you from Sweden?
People say that?
Of course, absolutely. You must pay thousands of dollars to get your hair done like that. Why don't you just go out in the sun and get a tan? Can't you just learn to drive? And these things happen again and again and again, not only to me, but to many people in the albinism community.
Do you think it's because maybe it's not really perceived as a disability as such, therefore people feel perfectly comfortable being nosy Parkers? Do you think that's it?
My surname being Parker, thanks for that. I think people, and I've come to learn this, that people usually are just genuinely interested in indifference. And I think there can be the tendency to be overly sensitive when people do ask, and to say, they're criticising me, they're discriminating against me. But usually people actually have never met a person with albinism. There's only 1,300 of us in Australia. And so they just are genuinely interested. And so I see in that situation, if they ask a question that's silly, or that where they don't know, it's actually an opportunity to educate. And then those people may go on to the next person and explain what it is.
How are people born with albinism?
Albinism is a genetic condition, and it's what we call an autosomal recessive condition. So it takes you back to your high school science, which means that you have to have a double dose of the gene to have the condition. So you've got to get one copy of it from your mum and one copy of it from your dad, or there may be a new change that's come. And the people who have only got one copy of the gene generally don't have the condition, but what we're learning now is that they may tend to be fairer than their siblings who don't have any copies of the gene. So there may be a carrier state, and we're just learning a bit more about that now.
Is there one kind of albinism or many kinds?
There are quite a few, in fact. So the big two categories is ocular albinism, which is only affecting the eyes, and not so much the hair and skin. And then you've got oculo, the eyes, cutaneous skin albinism, so oculocutaneous albinism or OCA. And then under that category, there are a whole lot of subcategories. I, even as a doctor, only learned about these different subcategories about 7 years ago. I was pretty much in denial about my albinism up until then.
Is it more common in men or women?
Ocular albinism is more common in men. It's what we call a sex-linked change. But in OCA or oculocutaneous, the gender proportion is equal.
Your eyes are blue, and that's how it is for people with albinism. But they appear red at times. What's causing that, Shari?
I have met literally hundreds of people with albinism in my life, both here in Australia, in Malaysia, in the States, and I have never met one person with red or pink eyes. Sometimes a little bit of violet.
Wow, where's that coming from then? Why do I think that then?
Why do you think that? Well, it comes from the portrayal of albinism in popular culture, and it also comes from, say, you think of albino, you'll think of a lab rat, won't you? And they often do have red eyes.
My God, I'm hideously embarrassed now. That's terrible to think that, isn't it? Is it a really common held misperception then?
Absolutely, absolutely. The evil albino with red eyes, but it doesn't happen. Sometimes, as I said, perhaps a violet, but the vast majority of people, and we just had our conference with 75 people with albinism from around Australia. I didn't see any with red eyes there.
Are there countries in the world where there's a higher incidence of albinism as opposed to other parts of the world?
Yeah. In some parts of Africa, there's a higher incidence. In Australia, it's about 1 in 17,000. But in some countries in Africa, they estimate it's 1 in 5,000. And then in some other parts of the world, particularly in the islands, where it's what we call a founder effect. So someone had the gene who helped to found that island or that area. And so there's an even higher incidence.
Is that because there's more likely to be tribal communities in those places?
That's exactly right, yeah.
So it seems very very uncommon, as you say. Does that mean it's poorly understood and poorly studied scientifically?
Yeah, there's no money to be made in finding a cure for albinism because it's so rare. So there's really not a lot of focus in terms of getting research done. The research that's done is often driven from within the albinism community.
Would there ever be a cure, or would it be a preventative measure that could take place?
Some of the research that was presented at the conference is actually very exciting in terms of looking to improve vision in people with albinism particularly. So there's recently been a medication trial, a drug trial done over in the States using L-DOPA, which is medication usually used for Parkinson's disease. And it was given to people with oculocutaneous albinism to help deposit some of the earlier ingredients that help to make the melanin. And the results of that study are yet to be released, but that's pretty exciting. And then the possibility of gene therapy, possibly in utero or maybe even after birth.
You mentioned there earlier that perception of the person with albinism as being wicked and evil with red eyes and all that. Is that to be found all over the world, or is it more intense in some places as opposed to other places?
That perception or the practical ramifications of that are certainly much more intense in Africa. I think in Australia, people will look at the person with albinism who appears different, and they've seen the movies where the person with albinism is portrayed as evil or supernatural powers, and that may be their perception, but it's not they don't actually believe it per se. But in Africa, it is a truth, it is a reality, and there have been over 125 documented murders of people with albinism in Africa, and that's only the ones that have been reported. So having albinism in Africa can be certainly life-threatening.
How about the practice of voodoo? How does that affect people with albinism in a place like Africa or the Caribbean.
Yeah. So in Tanzania, the beliefs that are propagated through parts of society are that an albino body part will bring good luck, good fortune, good favour.
No.
And that people with albinism aren't human. They're not human. They're not alive. They're just a separate species almost. And
like so a zombie or something.
A zombie, yeah, something, yeah. Exactly. And so dismembering a person with albinism, taking off a limb, removing the blood, is seen as a way of making money, as a way of making profit by selling those body parts to make a profit and to bring good fortune and favour to those to whom they sell it.
Obviously, thanks to the internet now, there's greater interconnectedness and greater knowledge amongst people all over the world. Obviously, your organisation is aware of this. What can be done to combat that kind of grotesque attack on human beings?
There are some organisations in the world who are doing incredible things in this area, and that has actually peaked in there being a resolution in the United Nations only within the last few months to further investigate and to do more to address these issues. But it seems that the governments in many parts of the world largely turn a blind eye to, excuse the pun, turn a blind eye to these issues.
Sherry, the funny thing is white can mean all sorts of things in different cultures. Kind of, some cultures it means light and angelic, and other countries it means, you know, death and evil and wickedness.
But certainly in Panama, I believe that people with albinism are often revered as and to be worshipped.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Right, in South America or Latin America, you can, in some parts, you can be revered as a godlike.
A god or a goddess, almost, yeah. But we don't have any magic, but when you put a whole bunch of us together, a degree of magic does happen. So having people with albinism all together at a conference, there is a degree of magic that happens when we do come together.
I spoke to a guy years and years ago who got on a train somewhere in China, in rural China, and he had pale skin and quite pale blue eyes. Mm. And recently an earthquake had been through the place, and slowly the hubbub around the train was that the devil is on board this train. How are people with albinism getting on in a place like China, for example, in the rural parts of China?
Again, not so much at risk of death as they would be in Africa, but with the one-child policy, you want to have a child who is perfect in every way. So there are a lot of orphans with albinism in China, and in fact our president of the Albinism Fellowship in Australia has had several trips to China to visit those orphanages and to learn more about the plight of those kids.
Were your parents aware that they were carrying the gene when they met? They wouldn't have been, would they? You have no way of knowing, really, unless you have an albino kid, do you?
That's exactly right. They certainly weren't. It's interesting. My mum tells a story of when she was a little girl and visiting the eye doctor, that he looked at the back of her eye and said, "Oh, it's very fair. I've only ever seen a retina this fair in an albino before." And she said to her mum, "What's an albino?" And her mum explained. And then it wasn't until 20 years later, when she had my sister, who was another albino, a person with albinism, that she again heard or thought of that word. So she doesn't have albinism, my mum, but has got some of the eye traits.
Is it common, given that it's genetic in origin, that someone like yourself will have a sibling who has also got albinism?
So when you look at the genetics of it, about one in four kids of two carrier parents will have the condition. But each time you flip a coin, and it just so happened that we got two out of three.
Given that when you were born with this condition, that people would have known it would have affected your sight, did that mean that your parents got all kinds of advice on how you were to be schooled?
Yes, my sister, who's older than me, my parents were told about her when they made the diagnosis at a few months of age. My parents were told to bring her back when she was five so that she could be placed in a blind school. And my parents decided not to accept that and decided to school us through the private sector, which I'm forever grateful for, and just to treat us as completely normal kids. If we wanted to go and climb trees or go hang gliding or climb rock faces or whatever, we were allowed to do it. And even when I announced at the age of 14 or so that I wanted to be a doctor, they didn't try to squash that or tell me that I couldn't. They perhaps cautiously encourage me in that.
Given that kids are brutal in the playground, if you've got a big nose, you'll be told you've got a big nose for the rest of your life every single day of your life at school. I wonder how it was for you, Shari.
There was the inevitable name-calling, but I had a close bunch of friends who stuck by me, and it didn't get to me too much. Well, not that I admit to. I think it probably was a bit tough at the time, but it didn't shatter me. I didn't spend a lot of time out in the playground. I wouldn't be the one playing tennis in the playground. I'd be the one who'd head off to the library, as so many of my counterparts tend to do. So maybe that's how helped to get me to where I am.
How about your eyesight? How did that affect you in the classroom? What kind of workarounds did you come up with for that?
So I was never the one who wanted to be sitting at the front of the classroom. I didn't want to be different from anyone else. So I had just very basic equipment, a monocular, fondly known as a spyglass. So I'd use that to see the whiteboard or the blackboard.
Hang on. You didn't want to be different. So you basically looked at the blackboard through a telescope, essentially.
That's right, yeah, and still do. So all throughout university, used my spyglass to see the lectures. And I remember having a comment from one of my fellow medical students who thought that I was trying to have an advantage over the other students. He thought it was a special camera and I was videoing or taking photos of the slides, but no, it was just so that I could see.
Is there a kind of slang word for non-albino people amongst the albino community?
I guess the kinder one is people with pigment. Yeah. But the late Dr. Brian Evans coined the term pigmento, so which I think is quite good. And in fact, many of the presenters at the conference, even including those from the States, use that terminology in their slides.
Having super pale skin, of course, makes you really at risk when you go out in the sun. Have you or your sister ever been really severely burnt?
We've had a few occasions of some reasonably severe sunburn. My sister in particular, one day was at the swimming pool with her friends who were all out sunbathing, and to her credit, she did lie down on the chair and put a towel on herself, so that she didn't get quite so sunburnt. But in a sleep, she dozed off. It actually crept up her legs and her feet and her ankles got severely burnt, and I've certainly had some dreadful stories of people within our organisation have been burnt to the point where they've had to be hospitalised and have wet dressings and things like that.
So Australia, in many ways, in that sense anyway, is the worst country in the world to live in for someone
certainly
with your condition.
But I certainly just adjust my life accordingly. So I tend to head down to the beach at about 5 o'clock when everyone else is heading back from the beach. Maybe it's shark feeding time, but it's certainly much more pleasant for me at that time.
Shari, when did you know you wanted to be a doctor?
Grade 8, Mrs. Whiteman's science class, when we were dissecting bullseyes and various other body parts, I was fascinated with everything to do with how the body worked and what made it happen. And it was at that point that I said, this is what I want to do, not dissect bullseyes, but to learn more about the body, to learn how it worked, and then further on from that, to help other people who've got a disability or a health problem to have a better life.
Were you taught about albinism as a medical student?
There were two lines that I recall from my medical textbooks. Number one was within the dermatology text related to albinism being a lack of pigment and people with albinism having white hair and skin. And the other in the good old Talley and O'Connor textbook, which many doctors out there will have read, written by some doctors out at Penrith, where it said that there are two forms of nystagmus, and one of which is pendular nystagmus seen in albinism.
You talk about coming out of the closet as someone with albinism. Mm. What do you mean by that? Because, I mean, it's kind of really apparent. You don't have to, it's not like being gay, is it? I mean, it's really obvious.
It is pretty obvious, but I was someone who just wanted to get on and ignore it and just be a normal person. Then in 2006, one of our good family friends, Tim Bellamy, who has a daughter with albinism, he rang me up and he said, "Hey, Shari, you doctors like going to conferences. There's an albinism conference coming up just up the road from you in Sydney. Do you want to go?" And begrudgingly, I said yes.
Why begrudgingly? Oh, you didn't want a big deal?
I didn't want to admit it. So I went, with my husband and my kids, and my sister was there as well. And for those 2 days, I sat close to the back, weeping quietly through much of it. Really just, I guess, facing or admitting for the first time, you know, what I had and the effects that it has on one's life. And then on the Monday after the conference, the then president, Kim, she rang me up and she said, "Hey, Shari." Actually, she had severe laryngitis because she was totally exhausted and unwell after the conference. She said, "The ABC, they need someone to do an interview. I've already done one today. Can you do it?" And I remember I was there at childcare picking up my daughter. There were screaming kids all around. And it's like, okay, Kim, no worries. And that was the decision that has certainly changed the direction of my life.
Do you think you needed to go through that other phase to get to where you are first? Like, do you needed to go through that first phase of saying that I don't want to be anything special, don't want any special treatment, so you can get to this other point where now?
And that's something that I hear again and again with adults with albinism who have to go on that journey of self-awareness, of self-discovery, to really push the boundaries, to see what we can do, and then to try and incorporate that. The feature of albinism within our understanding of who we are.
How much do you hate the movies, Shari?
yes, the evil albino stereotype is rife in Hollywood, and even just this year another movie has been released, The Heat, where the person with albinism is misrepresented, somewhat differently in this case, but again misrepresented.
And that's the only circumstances in which someone with albinism would ever show up in a film, isn't it, too? Because there needs to be a reason for
that. There has to be a reason. You wouldn't just have a person with albinism as a standard actor, though I think you should. I think there should be more movies with people with albinism as the hero, perhaps, and not the one to be laughed at or jeered at, or to be the one to be shooting people.
Yeah, there is something there to be told. The story about someone who's misperceived as being touched by the devil or an angel or anything else, when in fact the alarming, shocking truth
is that, in fact, one in 70 people walking down the street carry an albinism gene without knowing it.
If people are listening to this and they've got a child who has albinism, a young child, what advice do you have for someone in that circumstance?
Just to love them as a normal kid. That people with albinism tend to be very dogmatic and stubborn and not listen to the word no. So educate yourself, educate your child about albinism, give them the language, give them the vocabulary to be able to understand their condition and to be able to explain it to other people, and they will go places and they will be fine.
Thank you, Shari.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.